question that many Christians entertain on a daily basis without ever thinking about it in these terms. What is the relationship between your faith and your reason, and how does the interaction between these two affect your ethics, your morality, especially in public life? We're going to be talking about and beginning a multi-part series on faith and public life with the author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June, Reasonable Ethics, Dr. Robert Benny. He joins us here in the first half hour for the beginning of this series. Then in the second half hour of Issues, Etc. today, Dr. Martin Noland will be our guest. He'll join us here in Studio A. The church remembers on this day 8th century bishop and missionary martyr Boniface. Name sound familiar? It should. We'll be talking a little bit about Boniface in about 25 minutes here on Issues, Etc. Starting at 4 o'clock, we're going to play for you an interview that we did earlier today, stopping and starting, getting your reaction as well as mine. We had an interview with Tim LaHaye. He is, of course, the co-author of the best-selling series of novels called the Left Behind series. They have published their 15th. It's actually part of the prequel to the series of the Left Behind, and has to do with the rapture. So we talked a little bit with him about the rapture, about his viewpoint of the end times, what his book is all about. We'll be playing that for you starting in the second hour of Issues, Etc. I invite your questions and comments both then and now, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Then at 5 o'clock, let's see, we will be, at 5:30, the last half hour, we will be talking about the federal marriage amendment that's being debated in the U.S. Senate, and we'll get your reaction to it as well. The president has had a few things to say. A proponent of gay marriage says that there's no biblical reason for there not to be gay marriage. We'll hear all of that and get your reaction and a little bit of audio open lines in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers again, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. We are coming to you live this Monday. It's the 5th of June. Dr. Robert Benny is author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June, Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns. He's Professor Emeritus of Religion and Director of the Center for Religion and Society at Roanoke College. Dr. Benny, welcome to Issues, Etc.
It's a delight to be with you.
How you think about the interaction between your faith and your reason has changed for you. How did you used to put those two together, your faith and your reason, especially as it impinged upon ethics and morality?
Well, I'd say that my opinions about politics, social issues, and economics have changed, but probably the central beliefs about the Christian faith have not changed much over many years. And in the book, I try to argue that as one argues from the flaming center of Christian faith, one takes steps at which each step at which Christians of goodwill and intelligence often disagree. So Christians have different viewpoints, say, on the war in Iraq, different viewpoints on capitalism, but they should share the flaming central affirmations of the Christian faith. That's what holds us together.
So give us an example, if you would, on some of those issues upon which your mind has changed, informed as it has been, as you say, by the center of the Christian faith.
Right. Well, as I went through graduate school, the only kind of view of economics that was given to us was what one could call anti-capitalist economics. We read John Kenneth Galbraith and Karl Marx and anything to the left of that. And so we were hostile toward capitalism. And then just through happenstance, actually playing tennis with the University of Chicago economics professors, I found out that there was a whole range of economic opinion. And so I began to learn economics and found out that there was a very different viewpoints on capitalism, and I saw many virtues to capitalism that I hadn't seen before, and I wrote a book on capitalism from a Christian point of view called The Ethic of Democratic Capitalism, A Moral Reassessment, and in that book I tried to argue from a Christian point of view that there are many things that are good about capitalism and that Christians could participate in capitalist systems without a bad conscience. That didn't mean that they shouldn't be critical of capitalism.
How big of a change was that for you?
Oh, that was a huge change because it put me out of sync with religious intellectuals in general, Christian ethics people in general, and at the seminary I was then teaching at, people began to look at me as some sort of odd character, that I actually affirmed dimensions of capitalist life and life in the business world, the kind of received wisdom that was that business people were corrupt because they were involved in a corrupt economic system. So it put me at considerable tension with my profession, as it were.
What other issues that people might consider, say, political issues, on what other issues has your mind changed?
Well, came from political persuasions, too. That is, in graduate training and in the 60s, it was de rigueur or required or just assumed that you would be to the left politically. And as I went through the big disruptions of the 60s and later 60s and early 70s, I believe the 60s went from 65 to 75, I really reassessed my political persuasion and became something of a conservative in my political persuasion, even changed my viewpoint on the Vietnam War, which I had demonstrated against when I was a young professor in the 60s. So I took quite a different viewpoint on those matters, and that increasingly put me out of sync with my profession, which tends to be very much to the left politically.
Tell us a little bit about, you write early in your book when you're telling your own story and how formative it was for your viewpoints that you now hold. You talk about a meeting that you had at one point with, if I'm not mistaken, Rudolf Bultmann.
Yes, I certainly did.
Now, there's no bigger name. First, explain to our listeners who may not know who Bultmann is, and name names, tell us who he is and what his significance is, and then about the meeting.
Okay, well, Rudolf Bultmann was perhaps the major New Testament scholar of the first half of the 20th century, and even into, he still has a tremendous influence today. And in short, he believed that most of the Bible was mythology, and all the supernatural elements were myth. And in order to find the kernel of the Christian faith, you had to demythologize. You had to take all the transcendent or the supernatural stuff away to find the real kernel of the Christian gospel, which was now, looking back, heavily what was existentialism, that is, the radical decision to be and not to be. And Bultmann thought he had discovered the perennial gospel when, in fact, he was just reflecting the philosophy of his day, existentialism. But it still continues to be very influential and shocking, because none of the things that we think are essential to the Christian faith, like the resurrection, the incarnation, and the miracles of Jesus, he denied all those things. So when we were in graduate school in Germany with a bunch of Lutherans, actually, we decided to travel to meet very well-known theologians, and Bultmann was one of them. And one of our fellows, a very conservative Wisconsin Synod Lutheran, had read Bultmann and thought he was a heretic. And so Bultmann was very polite to us, and we conversed over coffee and Kuchen. And this fellow finally asked, we knew he was going to ask a hard question, and he got real red, and he says, Dr. Bultmann, is your theology a theology without God and without eternity? And Bultmann drew a long puff in his pipe and looked at the young man and said, I wouldn't say that, and went on to the next question.
What was that dismissive? Was it... What did you
well,
take from that?
It was probably more complex than our young friend had it, but essentially he was right. And Bultmann thought, as many liberals have thought, that they had to change the change Christianity in order to save it. And what often happened in those efforts was they threw the baby out with the bathwater. They compromised essential parts of the Christian faith. And most Orthodox Christians today would look at Bultmann as something of out of date, and who in fact had jettisoned way too much of the Christian faith in his effort to make Christian faith relevant. He thought we had to tailor all these things to fit the modern scientific worldview, which he didn't think allowed for miracles or supernatural elements.
You also write about some late-night meetings, at least brief ones, with a regular guest here on this program, Richard John Neuhaus, while he was still in the Lutheran fold before he converted to Rome. And this, of course, takes place at a very formative time in your life during the 60s at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. Tell us about it.
Well, yeah, so wonderful story. Richard John was still a Lutheran in New York City in an impoverished parish and still to the left politically, and was actually elected to be a representative to the 1968 Democratic Convention. And he would engage in actions, that is, demonstrations and civil disobedience, and be taken to prison and let go again. And then he'd come down to the South Side, Hyde Park, where I taught, and regale us with stories of his exploits during the day. But then, of course, Richard had many of the change of minds that I was talking about just before. The 60s were such a powerful crucible in which you were pressed to identify who you really were, politically, economically, but above all, religiously. And Richard took a different direction after those 60s and became a person of the right, conservative politically, economically, and socially. And I moved in a similar direction at the same time, but he was much more visible than I was, so it was a comforting thing to have Richard out there in the front making these changes.
We're talking with Dr. Robert Benet. He is author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June, Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns. We begin a multi-part series today with him on faith and public life. He's Professor Emeritus of Religion and Director of the Center for Religion and Society at Roanoke College. I got to ask one more question about Richard John Neuhaus.
Yeah.
In those days when he was, and I think he takes even nowadays, a fair amount of pride in his, in particular, his participation in the civil rights movement. But in those days, would you have ever thought that you would be reading Richard John Neuhaus in First Things, his journal, saying the things he says today?
Well, no, I guess I wouldn't have thought that, but I wouldn't have thought I would ever be a political conservative either. So all of those, a lot of those surprises followed from the trauma of the 60s. And many people who were on the left were, as Irving Kristol said, mugged by reality and moved to the right politically and often religiously, too. Although I think Richard was always probably just a stable Lutheran at the very center, as I've always thought myself to be. But we moved a long distance politically and economically with our opinions. And I'm not even surprised that he moved to Catholicism over the swing of many years. He had many Catholic sympathies as a young man, so it wasn't a great shock, but a saddening moment when he decided to leave us and move to Rome.
How is your story, your move kind of from the solid center of the left, politically, economically, perhaps even ethically, in other respects, how is it more than just a coming-of-age saga of someone who kind of had those heady days of youthful idealism and then they're put away? What's different about that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think it was some wise person said, if when you're young you're not a radical, you have no heart. If when you're old you're not a conservative, you have no brain. So in one way, I guess I've moved a fairly conventional, taken a fairly conventional trajectory, moving from kind of youthful idealism to more what I consider to be measured conservatism. But I think what was really powerful about that is living through the 60s. I don't think the same sorts of trajectory would have happened without that cataclysmic event. And perhaps without the kind of exposure to liberalism I had as a young person in graduate school, which really fired me up. Because then the 60s kind of dissipated and undermined and actually fractured that idealistic liberalism of John F. Kennedy in the early part of the 60s. So it follows the kind of trauma of American history in a way that's probably less conventional.
Talk a little bit about the 60s as an era. I was born in the 60s, right, in the center of it, and I count myself as on the very, very trailing edge of the baby boom generation. A couple months more and I would not have gone into that generation at all. I would have missed it.
Right.
But you're probably out there on the leading edge of the baby boom generation. Is there a difference? What's the difference between mine and your generation as kind of bookends on what is called the baby boom?
Well, the 60s, as I said before, I think went from the 65 to 75. And the early 60s were still continuous with the post-war kind of domination of political liberalism in a rather healthy sort. The John F. Kennedy, tough-minded foreign policy, rather traditional moral values in society, not in his private life. But then from 65 onward, the kind of a whole bunch of things happened. One was the war. One is demographic. People don't often don't notice the fact that a huge contingent of people entered university training about that time. And just the fact that there were so many of them and they felt powerless and anonymous led to, I think, rebellious impulses. But there was the war, and then there was all these incipient liberation movements, particularly sexual liberation. That really got underway big time at the same time that the protest against the war got underway. And gay and lesbian movements began in earnest in those eras, as so did the ecological movement. And what happened, what was so powerful, is the myth of American innocence, which had kind of shaped and driven American public life up until 65, was turned on its head to become the myth of American guilt. So that viewing America as kind of a benign and almost redemptive presence in the world up to 1965 was flipped on its head, so that everything that was wrong with the world was America's fault, and America internally was corrupt, oppressive, and viewed highly negatively. And it was a tough reversal, and people really had to figure out who they were when that reversal took place. I don't think you had to live through that, did you?
No. I mean, well, perhaps only as a child, and then, of course, you're very unaware of the bigger movements when you're that age. But I was just thinking, it has been left in many ways to my generation, the last of the baby boomers, to, in some ways, respond to much of what was said or overstated in the 60s. Do you agree?
Yes, yes. And the other thing that you have that I certainly didn't have is there was no significant conservative movement up until 65 from the Second World War onward. It was all a dominant liberalism. Certainly Eisenhower was a Republican president, but everybody pretty much agreed upon the fundamental direction of American policy. But after the great reversal of the 65s, you had the emergence of a vibrant intellectually based conservative movement, which gained political power, flashes of it with Barry Goldwater in 64, but then emerging powerfully with the Reagan movement in the early 80s and upward through the Bushes. And so you got actually conservatives grabbing the ideas that formed the society after the 60s. And so you have real choices now between the far left, what moderate liberalism is left, and moderate conservatism, and then you have some very conservative conservatism. So you have a much greater range of political opinion in this country than you had, at least in my growing up years.
How did the role of, or that interaction of reason and faith, if you could look back on kind of the height of it for you in your days in the left, and now the height of it for you in your days perhaps in the right, how did the relationship of faith and reason change, if at all, for you?
Well, as I say in the book, reason operates within religious streams. For many, many years, there was the claim of the Enlightenment that reason was autonomous, and now people have a lot less confidence about that. They believe that reason operates within religious traditions, so that the Islamic people are not irrational, but by George, they come to different conclusions, the Muslim nations, than we do. So they're operating within a different religious stream. So what I think happened was that I made different judgments about politics, economics, and social issues, and found my way trying to make the connections between my fundamental Christian convictions and those different political and economic options. And I found those connections, but I certainly admit that other people make those connections in different ways. So I think what justifies us as Christians is not our political opinions and where we are on the political spectrum, but by our belief in the fundamental affirmations of the faith, especially as it's viewed by Lutherans. We are justified by grace through faith on account of Christ. And then we are free in many ways to work our way through this forest of different political opinions and come to different judgments as Christians. However, there are limits to that. One can't become a rabid racist, or one can't become a rabid atheist and still be within the Christian fold.
Very briefly, before we let you go here, Dr. Benne, does it frustrate you that there, and we only have a minute here.
Sure.
Does it frustrate you, and this is a frustration for me, that Christians particularly who would identify themselves of the right, many do, have a hard time distinguishing between what it means to be a Christian and what it means to, say, be a Republican? Does that frustrate you sometimes?
Well, it certainly does, but they learn their lessons from the left, who from the mainstream Christian groups, and I'm in a liberal denomination, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and when they make arguments politically or economically, they're always on the liberal side. So, well, I call it straight line thinking. That is, you move from you think there's a straight line from your Christian convictions to political opinions, and that straight line is disturbing on either the left or the right. So there's not such a thing as Christian politics. God is not a Republican or a Democrat.
Then, with only 30 seconds,
yep.
How can Reasonable Ethics, this book, be helpful as a resource for a layperson?
Well, I think they will see in the book, when I make judgments about economics and politics, social issues, culture, sport, music, they will see that I make moves that they may want to follow. And they may not want to follow. And the point of the persuasiveness of my argument is that they might move those steps along with me and be persuaded that they are reasonable steps given the starting point in the Christian faith.
Dr. Robert Benne is Professor Emeritus of Religion and Director of the Center for Religion and Society at Roanoke College. He is author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June, Reasonable Ethics, A Christian Approach to Social, Economic, and Political Concerns. It is a book worth reading, especially if you want to kind of track through those lines of thinking from faith through reason to ethical decisions. You can find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask them about Reasonable Ethics by Dr. Robert Benne, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Dr. Benne, pleasure talking to you. Look forward to our next conversation.
Pleasure to talk with you. Very good questions.
Thank you. Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to take up the issue of the federal marriage amendment. Here is an issue where Christians might also disagree. Robert Knight of the Culture and Family Institute for Concerned Women for America will be our guest.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Deaconess Pam Nielsen, senior editor at Concordia Publishing House, on the Christ-centered cross focus of Growing in Christ, the new Sunday school curriculum from Concordia Publishing House.
We've been very intentional in one, teaching the scriptures. We are concerned about Bible literacy. Pastors tell us they get kids in confirmation that they don't know any of the Bible stories, they don't know any of the Bible people. So we're trying to teach the Bible stories, the who, what, where, and when. But we're teaching them in the context of Christ, and every story, every week, be it Old or New Testament, connects to Christ as the Savior.
For more information about Growing in Christ, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or find the Growing in Christ logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. It's a Christ-centered, cross-focused Sunday school curriculum, Growing in Christ.
A new poll shows America is trending pro-life. This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
75% of Americans say they believe abortions should never be allowed only in very limited circumstances, or not be allowed past the first trimester of pregnancy. The poll, commissioned this spring by the Susan B. Anthony List and the Real Women's Voices Coalition, held that 54% of respondents identified with one of three traditionally pro-life statements. Abortion should never be legal, only be legal to save the life of the mother, or only be legal in cases of rape, incest, or to save the mother's life. Scarcely 41% of respondents chose a so-called pro-choice view.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Can you get HIV from kissing? No, but 37% of Americans think you can. Can you get it by sharing a drinking glass? Again, no, but 22% say you can. 16% of Americans think you can get HIV from a toilet seat. You can't. And 55% don't know that a pregnant woman who has HIV now can take drugs so the virus will not be passed to her child. Those are some statistics reported by the Kaiser Family Foundation in May. Today marks the 25th anniversary of the first report from the Centers for Disease Control about AIDS, the acquired immune deficiency syndrome. The disease was first found among gay men, a fact that has stigmatized HIV carriers who are not homosexual. Deborah Shelton of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch wrote about 12-year-old Josh Pillman, a normal, all-American boy who got HIV from his mother. She had received tainted blood in a transfusion after a car accident 20 years ago. To see your child shunned is tough on parents. Josh's dad says, people don't even know the basics, to know that they don't have to worry about casual contact. There are 2.3 million children around the world who have HIV. Jesus was upset the disciples kept children from him. Do we do the same by not knowing more facts?
Benjamin Franklin was many things in addition to his being the only American to sign all five founding documents of the United States. He would have celebrated his 300th birthday this year, and the Missouri Historical Society marks the occasion by welcoming the international traveling exhibition, Benjamin Franklin, In Search of a Better World, to the History Museum in Forest Park on June 9th. This massive effort to bring the man and his accomplishments to life will remain on display until September 4th. Visit mohistory.org to find out more.
These amendments and laws express a broad consensus in our country for protecting the institution of marriage. Unfortunately, activist judges and some local officials have made an aggressive attempt to redefine marriage in recent years.
That's President Bush speaking in his Saturday radio address. He had devoted that short radio address to his support for the Federal Marriage Amendment. We're going to be talking about that amendment, currently being debated in the U.S. Senate as we speak. Robert Knight will join us here in just a moment. Before we go to that conversation, a little change in our lineup. Robert Knight is going to be our guest as we talk about the Federal Marriage Amendment. Dr. Martin Noland will join us at the beginning of the second hour to talk about 8th century bishop and missionary and martyr Boniface. And then we're going to spend the last 90 minutes of the program listening to an interview we did earlier today with Dr. Tim LaHaye on the rapture and getting your reaction. It'll be audio open lines. We also have some more audio to play on the Federal Marriage Amendment there during audio open lines. That's the change in our lineup. Then I want you to go to our website, issuesetc.org. We're always looking for feedback from our listeners. But we thought, since the website says I'm going on vacation, but it's actually Jeff who's going on vacation, and so I go on vacation too, we're going to have a whole week of Issues, Etc. We're going to be playing. Usually we play best of, and we thought to ourselves, why not devote each day of that week, 5 days, Monday through Friday, to our listeners' top Issues, Etc. guests, so that if you vote to, say, Dr. Norman Nagel, he gets a whole day. You get a whole 3 hours on Monday of Dr. Norman Nagel.
When is he going on vacation?
The 12th through the 15th, something in that neighborhood, all right? Craig loves this because all he does is play CDs all day long and he doesn't have to look at me. If you vote for Larry Rast, Tuesday, all day, 3 hours, Larry Rast. Best of Larry Rast. We thought, what a great idea. It was Jeff's idea, by the way. That's what he gets paid to do, is have these ideas. So we've got a survey for you at our website, issuesetc.org. When you get there, click Listen Online. Issuesetc.org, then click Listen Online. That'll take you to the KFUO website where we have the survey. It's the People's Choice Awards. That's what we're calling it. Yes, it's corny. So we're going to devote 3 hours each day next week to an interview with our top five guests. We've got some names suggested there. Among them, Dr. Paul Meyer, Craig Parton, Ron Rhodes, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, Stephen Hine, Lewis Brighton, Ken Cherb, Carl Fakencher, Rod Rosenblatt, Dr. Norman Nagel, Dr. David Adams, Arthur Jest, all of those names up there. What we want you to do is do this. It's not complicated. Email us at issuesetc.org. There's a link right there to the email, issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Your top five out of that list. Your top five in an email. Don't have to say hello. Just type in the names. You can even copy them off the website there. Your top five. And the top five, voting will end at 5:30 p.m. Eastern on Thursday, June the 8th. That's our deadline. And then the whole next week, your listeners, People's Choice, top five, Issues, Etc. guests, every day, a new top five guest of Issues, Etc. I think it's a great idea. Don't you, Craig?
What?
It's a great idea. He loves the idea for all sorts of reasons, and you can thank Jeff Swartz for that idea.
I'm sure I stole it from somewhere. I've never had an original idea in my life.
Neither have I. So, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Go now and vote for your top five. Go to the website, issuesetc.org, click Listen Online, and then email us with your top five Issues, Etc. guests. Robert Knight is director of the Culture and Family Institute for Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. He joins us to talk about a federal marriage amendment. Bob, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Bob, what is being debated by the Senate right now, and what has the president thrown his support behind as of last week?
Okay, it's called the Marriage Protection Amendment, and it was introduced by Senator Allard of Colorado, and it's a two-sentence marriage amendment that first defines marriage as the union only of a man and a woman, and then it says that United States Constitution nor any state constitution can be construed to require the transfer of marital benefits to other relationships. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. This amendment went down to defeat in 2004. There were only 48 votes to invoke cloture, which is when you stop debate and you vote on the actual amendment. So there hasn't been an actual vote on the amendment itself yet. There was one in the House in 2004, and it was approved, but by nowhere near the 290 votes they'd need. I think they got 227. Here's the thing. A regular law being passed by Congress only needs 50 votes plus the vice president's if he chooses to break a tie. But a constitutional amendment needs 67 Senate votes. I don't see those votes. I don't even see 60 to stop a filibuster if the liberals want to stop this amendment.
So,
but that doesn't mean people shouldn't call the Senate and voice their support for traditional marriage.
All right. What would it do in the case of, say, Massachusetts, where they do have legalized gay marriage, full-blown, not just same-sex unions, but legalized gay marriage, or in New York, where at least at the appeals level, they are contemplating granting marriage licenses to applicants who are of same gender?
Well, in New York, it's the law of the land is still just traditional marriage. Massachusetts, it would overturn the gay marriage law in Massachusetts, but it wouldn't touch something like the civil unions law in Vermont, which has all the features of marriage without the word marriage. Or in Connecticut, same thing. They passed a full-blown civil unions law. So I'm afraid this marriage amendment doesn't have language that would actually do the job and protect marriage top to bottom like other amendments would. But I still think it's important that the American people make their sentiments known to the Senate that they want to protect marriage. They don't want it to be counterfeited.
So would you view this, Bob, as a dry run for a better marriage amendment that would address the issue of marriage by another name? At least that's what I take you to be saying, same-sex unions?
Yeah, I would. And here's the interesting twist, I think. We'd actually be for an amendment that's simpler and more passable, and that would just be a single sentence. A marriage in the United States shall consist only of the union of a man and a woman, period. I wouldn't even hint at any civil union arrangements by the states, so the states would have to work that out themselves. But I think this would remove any hiding places for senators who say that, well, I'm for marriage between a man and a woman, but the second sentence is too much for me. It's too complicated. Scholars interpret it many ways, so I can't vote for this flawed amendment. But if you have just a straightforward, hey, this is what marriage is, I don't know how anybody could not vote for it.
So in other words, this amendment, one of its weaknesses is perhaps that it gives someone who may be want to an excuse to vote against it.
Yes, it does. And it only binds judges. It doesn't bind legislatures. That's one reason we've been very critical of it. We feel that nobody should be able to counterfeit marriage, whether it's a judge or even a state legislature. You know, in California, a majority in both houses voted for a gay marriage bill, full-blown gay marriage. You know, two men are a marriage under California law, but it was vetoed by Governor Schwarzenegger. But that shows that it isn't just judges who are out of control on this. I think most of the damage has been done by judges. They've been overturning marriage amendments. And when people say, well, you don't need it, this shouldn't be a federal issue. You know, marriage has always been handled by the states. Well, they've been trying. 45 states either have new laws or full-blown constitutional amendments that ban anything but man-woman marriage, and judges have been overturning them all over the place. In Georgia recently, a judge overturned their marriage amendment, even though 76% of the people voted for it. A federal judge overturned the Nebraska state constitutional amendment, even though 70% of the people voted for it. So obviously, the states are doing their best to protect marriage, and yet judges all over the land are saying, no, we have a better idea, and we're going to impose our vision on you. I think that's why we need a federal marriage amendment eventually.
Massachusetts, you mentioned there that it would overturn the statute there that has gay marriage. What would become of the so-called marriages that have been enacted since Massachusetts approved gay marriage?
No, I think they'd just be dissolved the way the 13th Amendment just dissolved contracts when people bought and sold other human beings. Suddenly, the arrangements were no longer legal. And it doesn't mean it won't be a little messy for some people, but I think that the idea of a marriage without a bride, and then that understanding being forced on everyone, is worth the legal entanglements that may result. You have to understand that in Massachusetts, the impact of the gay marriages since 2004 has been very powerful. A second-grade teacher in Lexington read a book called King and King to her pupils, and it was about a prince who didn't want a princess and rejected them all and ended up going off with a prince, and they became kings together and were treated like husband and wife. And she read this to second graders, confusing the heck out of them. And when parents objected, she said, hey, it's the law of the land, so I don't have to inform parents before I expose kids to this kind of material. So it has direct impact on everyone. Businesses are forced to subsidize relationships that their faith may tell them is a sin, whether if they're a Christian, a Jew, or a Muslim. It puts the government in the position of saying traditional morality is now a form of bigotry and hatred, and we're going to come after you. That's really where it's all headed.
What do you make of the president's support? It's been expressed most strongly in the last week or so, and he hinted at support beforehand, but always kind of said, look, I'm going to let the lawyers look into this, and when they tell me what's right, when they tell me what they think is good as far as an amendment go, then you'll find out what I am supporting. But what do you make of his support for the present amendment, and do you believe that he would be supportive of what you mentioned before, a simpler but stronger marriage amendment?
Well, he gave a very good speech today. Actually, I was there at the White House, and he gave a very forceful defense of marriage and made clear that it was a national issue and the judges were wreaking havoc and there needed to be a solution. As far as how much support he's given it, I think what the focus ought to be on the U.S. Senate, because they're the ones with the power to actually pass the thing. The president has a bully pulpit, and he has not used it much on this issue up till now. We have been disappointed. He hasn't really made the case for marriage. You know, this morning's exercise was very good, but it's kind of late in the game. That the vote on the amendment will happen tomorrow or the next day, so that's not really a very strenuous campaign for this piece of legislation. I think he needs to do more to articulate why it's so important to defend marriage.
Why do you think he's been coming, that he has come late to this issue?
Well, I think there's some ambiguity in the Bush administration. You got Mary Cheney, the Cheney's daughter, who's an out lesbian who has openly condemned the marriage amendment. You've got people like Mary Madeline who have promoted gay rights. And I think there are other people within the administration that really aren't conservative in terms of defending marriage. And I think the president himself has been preoccupied with Iraq, with the price of gas, with all kinds of things. And I think that the administration should have treated this more seriously than they have, but you know, better late than never. I'm glad he made the speech this morning, and I hope it leads to renewed efforts to persuade a majority of legislators that we really do need a marriage amendment.
On the off chance that the Senate were to actually muster up 67 votes to approve, what would happen next with the marriage protection amendment?
Okay, the amendment would then go to the House, and they'd have to get 290 votes. That's two-thirds of the House. Last time they got 227, I think. So that's a real tall order. You know, you have the leaders of the Democratic Party on record opposing any federal marriage amendment, no matter how it's worded. So you'd have to have all the Republicans voting for it, and then you'd have to have a defection of a considerable number of Democrats. That's why I don't see it happening this year. But, it could be that we'll have to have more cultural turmoil. We'll have to have some very real consequences from the spread of gay marriage before people wake up and protect it. But I fear that it might be too late by then, and we'll be living in a situation like Scandinavia, where they've recast marriage as something old-fashioned and not necessary, and now a great majority of children are being born out of wedlock. The most young people aren't getting married at all, and Stanley Kurtz of the Hoover Institution has done a tremendous series of articles showing how gay marriage is the nail in the coffin of marriage itself. It didn't start the slide toward dissolution of marriage and respect for marriage in the Swedish culture, but it was a sign to everyone that you don't even need a man and a woman anymore. So how important could an actual marriage be? You know, these young people are looking at it saying, oh, what the heck, we'll just shack up. You know, and by the way, why should we limit it to one partner? You know, once you break the gold standard of marriage and say it's no longer a priority, then anything goes. And I think that's the final goal of the gay rights movement. They've made it very clear in a number of statements that they want to lower the age of consent. They want to get rid of the two-partner limitation on recognizing relationships. In fact, the current Advocate magazine has a big article on gay polygamy and how a lot of gay relationships are really a form of polygamy. So that wouldn't bother them if polygamy came in on the heels of gay marriage.
So as I've often observed, once you redefine marriage as something other than a man and a woman, you cannot help but redefine it as anything other than a man and a woman.
Yeah, there's no logical stopping point. Once you've decided the real thing, the union of a man and a woman, the very essence of the relationship is no longer even necessary. And men and women are interchangeable, and therefore they're optional. Once you get to that point, everybody can make their own demands. There was even a guy who wanted to marry a horse. And I mean, we can laugh at that, but he was dead serious. He thought, who are you to impose your morality on me? I want to marry a horse, and those are my feelings. Well, when you base marriage on feelings rather than on the objective criteria of having a man and a woman of marriageable age and consanguinity requirements, then anything goes. It really and here's the thing: when marriage breaks down, it is the beginning of a whole cavalcade of social ills, from high crime to illiteracy to spread of sexually transmitted diseases, alcohol and drug abuse. You can judge a community's health by the number of solid, mother and father based husband and wife marriages.
How will we be able to, in this case, we're going to see whatever the vote is here within the next 24 hours or thereabouts in the Senate. How will we be able to gauge the real legislative will in the Senate on this gay marriage amendment, given the fact that it's an election year? There may well be people who are voting, those of the Senate who are standing for re-election, one-third of them, who may vote for it knowing it's not going to pass. So they've counted up the votes. They say, well, it's safer for me to vote for it knowing it's not going to pass now. So will it really be a reflection of the legislative will regarding a federal marriage amendment?
You know, that's an excellent question, and that's true about a lot of issues where people cut a deal with the interest groups in their own party, and they defect to the other side knowing full well something's not going to pass, and they say, well, we've got to do this. We've got to be pragmatic and show the flag here, but I'm with you, wink, wink, don't worry about it. I don't know which ones they are. I think that, therefore, it's up to people to determine whether their representative or senator is sincere by what they say and do. If they don't lift a finger to make the case for marriage, then they're probably really not interested in doing so, you know, whether they vote for it or not. But you can bet the people who vote against this amendment really don't have marriage at heart and are really more interested in carrying water for the homosexual activists.
The next step, of course, is, and it's already, if not on the front burner with many activists, it is certainly in the middle of the range top, and that is gay adoption. If, say, in Massachusetts, it is legal for same-sex couples to marry with all the rights and benefits and privileges, that would of necessity, I would think, include adoption.
Oh, absolutely, and that's a big part of this. In fact, in Vermont, the Vermont Supreme Court, which ordered the legislators to either create gay marriage or civil unions, based their decision largely on the fact that Vermont had already allowed placement of children in homosexual households. And they said, well, gee, a key element of marriage is protecting children and seeing that they're in stable households. If the state thinks so much of homosexual relationships that they really aren't making a distinction, then why should we make a distinction in the marriage law? And one of the Massachusetts legislators, who was a liberal, boasted on the floor of the Massachusetts Assembly that 40% of the children in Massachusetts put up for adoption were going to gay households. Now, think about that. 40% of the kids are going to gay households? That means gay households are being privileged to accept children. You know, it's gone beyond, hey, we're going to allow homosexual couples to adopt, to we actually prefer them adopting to make a political point. Also in Massachusetts, Catholic Charities has now been forced out of the adoption placement business because the state said, well, because of the marriage law, we say you have to place children in homosexual households or lose your ability to deal with any adoptions. So Catholic Charities, to its credit, said, well, look, we know what God says, and we're not going to deliberately do something we think is wrong, so we're not going to place any kids anymore. And it's really sad because they specialized in placing the most hard-to-adopt kids. So the state is more interested in pleasing the small homosexual lobby there than and greater social goods like placing children in adoptive homes.
We've had many guests on to talk about same-sex marriage, civil unions, the various amendments that have come and gone. And many of them have pointed out that the reason the word marriage is so very important to the homosexual activists who are pushing for gay marriage or against a federal marriage amendment is that it confers sanction, public approval, beyond just what a couple of the same sex or the different sex could get through some other kind of contractual means, rights and privileges. Marriage, that word carries with it public sanction. What do you think?
Oh, I think that's right at the heart of this, because right now homosexuals can pretend to be married. They can get married in a church of their choosing, whether it's Unitarian or a very liberal Episcopal church. What they want is to use the power of the law to force others to say that this is really a marriage when people know it's not. That's getting into everybody else's head, and it has very real consequences. You know, in California, just under the domestic partnership law, businesses cannot do business with the state unless they subsidize homosexual relationships. So if you're a Christian, Jewish, or Muslim businessman and you think it's a sin to actually aid and abet an ongoing homosexual relationship, you're told you can't do business with your own government. So you see where the power comes in. It's not about tolerance. It's about using government power to force acceptance of a counterfeit form of marriage on everyone. And it has very real consequences from school children on up through business people.
You talked about those consequences before. Would the consequences be the same if a federal marriage amendment were to pass, either this one or another, that would restrict the definition of marriage but still leave the door wide open for same-sex unions?
Well, that's a great question, because, and that's one reason we haven't given our full support to this amendment, because we feel that we need a better one. We've actually backed something called the Institution of Marriage Amendment, crafted by Michael Ferris of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association and president of Patrick Henry College. And that's a very simple amendment that has the same first sentence, and then the second sentence just says you can't give marital benefits to any other relationship. It's very, very simple. We're told that, oh, well, that can't pass. It's just too clear. And if the Bush administration doesn't want it, and the leaders on the Hill don't want it, then it isn't going to pass anytime soon. But I think just a single amendment that is arguably weaker but more passable and clearer and less open to legal challenge, such as marriage is the union of a man and a woman, just real straightforward, I would think that would be the next step now that, you know, this marriage protection amendment is probably going to face defeat this week for the second time. You know, they will have tried it twice with this language, and I think it's time to be a little creative and try something else. Meanwhile, we ought to be impeaching judges who take it in their own hands to recreate law, make up law, and violate their oaths of office to merely interpret law.
Then, with only about 10 seconds, do you expect, if not a federal marriage amendment, at least the issue of gay marriage and same-sex unions to be a big issue in 2008 in a presidential election?
Yes, I do, because the groups that we work alongside are very adamant that this is one of those crucial issues that the country cannot ignore. And so we're going to work very hard to make sure it's at the center of any political campaign anywhere. And we don't care whether it's a Democrat or Republican. If you get behind marriage, you're a friend of the family.
CWFA.org is the website address for Concerned Women for America, CWFA.org. Robert Knight is director of the Culture and Family Institute for Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. Bob, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll wait and see what happens. Does not look hopeful for the federal marriage amendment, but that might turn out to be good news after all, if it's a weak amendment that wouldn't do what needs to be done. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend the second hour, at least the first part of it, with Dr. Marty Noland. He's joining us here in Studio A to talk about 8th century bishop, missionary, and martyr Boniface. Now, you've probably seen it all over Catholic high schools. Boniface High School, St. Boniface High School. Who was Boniface? We'll find out after this, and then at the 4:30 hour, we'll start our review of our interview earlier this afternoon with Dr. Tim LaHaye of the Left Behind series. Stay tuned. Hour 2 is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.